discount, but in one stop you can get gifts for the entire family. That's BerkeyWater.com or call 888-803-4438. That's 888-803-4438.
This is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at. Illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, the views of our guests, and, well, for this next hour, our guest is going to be, or at least half hour, Mr. Stephen P. Holbrook, and we're going to be talking about his book, The Founder's Second Amendment, The Origin of the Right to Keep and Bear Arms. And, of course, I should mention Mr. Holbrook is a lawyer. He graduated from Georgetown University. He got a Ph.D. in social science, from the Florida State University. He received his doctorate degree in law at Georgetown University. He is actually a research fellow at the Independent Institute in Oakland, California. And, of course, he's presented several cases before the Supreme Court. But, of course, we're going to be talking today about his book, The Founder's Second Amendment, The Origin of the Right to Bear Arms. Mr. Holbrook, thank you so very much for being with us.
It's my pleasure to be on the program.
Why don't you tell us a little bit about what got you so involved in writing so extensively about the Second Amendment? Why is that really so important today?
Well, when I was younger, as an undergraduate, and there was very little written about it, the Second Amendment, I've written four books now, the Founder's Second Amendment being the latest one, and it always was striking to me how little understood the amendment was. There's always been a lot said about the First Amendment and the Fourth Amendment and whatnot, but it's been pretty much ignored, and it finally got its day in the sun yesterday when the Supreme Court recognized in a very much of a landmark decision that it really is an important right, the right of the people to keep and bear arms.
All right, fine. And certainly this really is almost a watershed event, isn't it? I mean, certainly this is the first time in many years that the Supreme Court has actually addressed this specific issue as to whether or not local communities have the right to restrict the right of the people to keep a weapon in their own home for self-defense.
That's right. It's a right that's always been taken for granted in the United States, and most Americans agree with the interpretation that the Supreme Court came out with yesterday, that they have a personal right to keep arms if so choose in their homes. But 30 years ago, the District of Columbia banned any handgun possession in the home, and the Supreme Court hasn't looked at the issue since 1939 in a very brief and curt decision. And so now we have, after I started publishing books and a number of other scholars started doing so in the 1980s, basically, there's now quite a large scholarly literature. And the court drew upon that literature and has quite a comprehensive opinion on the Second Amendment. It's kind of like the Second Amendment was a Bill of Rights provision that sort of embarrasses you, so you sweep it into the closet and ignore it, and finally it's coming to its own.
Well, of course, the thing is that it really shouldn't be a matter of the opinion of the Supreme Court justices. It should be, in my estimation, what did the founders mean when they put the Second Amendment into the Constitution? And that's really what you've done. You've evaluated what the founders actually said, haven't you?
That's right. And beginning with, why did they think this was a problem that needed to be in the Bill of Rights? And it all started in the pre-revolutionary period. In 1768, the British troops were coming to occupy Boston, and the colonists feared that one of the first things they would do would be to disarm them and to take them to England and try them for treason without any jury of their peers. And things escalated in those years up until 1775, when you have Lexington and Concord. And what's little known about that episode is that after that event, the colonists won that first skirmish. And then the British imposed a ban on firearms in Boston, in the city of Boston. But they said that if you would turn in your gun with your representatives, they would be kept safely. You just give your name and
Hold that thought right there. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this afternoon is Stephen Holbrook, who's a lawyer. He's got his lawyer law degree, a doctorate in law at Georgetown University, and his PhD at Florida State University. He's taught political philosophy and of course now he's a practicing lawyer in Virginia, but he's written a number of books about the Second Amendment, which he feels is really very, very important. And of course, his book has been quoted by some of the Supreme Court justices, having to do with some of their decisions and their attitude towards what does the Second Amendment really mean? Does it mean you have to be part of the militia to have a gun? Or does every American have the right to keep and bear arms? And of course, the exciting things, as Mr. Holbrook has referred to, is the fact that the recent decision, the Heller case before the Supreme Court, when the Supreme Court said no, the American people have the right to have weapons to defend themselves. It's not simply, you know, for hunting purposes. And of course, he was just beginning to tell us a little bit about the history of guns here in America, really going back to the pre-revolutionary period, when the British wanted to prevent the colonists from having guns, and that was what the March on Lexington was by the Redcoats, the battle at Concord, the shot that was heard down around the world. So you pick up the story from there, Mr. Holbrook.
Well, going back further than that, it was a gradual process for the British to attempt to disarm the colonists. And you have, first of all, they thought about doing it, they debated it, and they decided they couldn't do it. It wouldn't be effective. And then as things kept escalating, you know, you had the Boston Massacre and the Boston Tea Party and the other events, clashes between the Patriots and the Tories and the Redcoats. And so you had the phenomenon of the British Crown prohibiting the exportation of arms and ammunition to the colonies. You have the beginning of the seizure of firearms. You have searches and seizures of people going in and out of Boston. And just one thing after another, and then finally you have the eruption of the Revolution. But that's the first third of my new book, The Founder Second Amendment, and then it goes into constitution making in the states. You had individual states adopting bills of rights for the first time, including one of the first ones was Pennsylvania, and it had a provision guaranteeing the right of the people to bear arms in defense of themselves and the state. And you move on into the period when the Constitution was proposed, and it had no Bill of Rights, and so a lot of people objected to that. And one of the main rights that was demanded was the right of the people to keep and bear arms. There were different ways it was phrased. Samuel Adams referred to the right...
Hold that thought. We're going to bring some other stations on board here. Well, this is Dr. Stan. I guess, of course, is Stephen Holbrook. We're talking about his book, The Founder's Second Amendment, The Origins of the Right to Bear Arms. And he was simply telling us the history of these things and how important this idea of the right to keep and people who keep and bear arms was, and mentioning that after, of course, the Constitution was written, the various states began to establish their constitutions and to establish a Bill of Rights for the individual states. And in Pennsylvania, what was the outcome of their effort to guarantee the right of the people to keep and bear arms?
Well, they adopted that right in their first Bill of Rights, which was in 1776, and then some other states did the same.
All right, fine. So what about what happened after that?
Well, that's when you move into the period when the Constitution was proposed, and it had no Bill of Rights, and that just terrified many people. And you had the great debate, and at first different states ratified the Constitution, and they refused to have a Bill of Rights, to propose one. But you have the first proposals for free speech and free press and religion and to keep and bear arms. And finally, a compromise was reached when the Constitution was debated in Virginia. And you had the forces in favor of a Bill of Rights were very strong. And so you had the compromise that they would adopt the Constitution, but when the first federal Congress met, that a Bill of Rights would be proposed and debated. And then after that point, the other states basically agreed that they would adopt the Constitution, but they were emphatic that it would include a Bill of Rights, and that's exactly what would happen in the future.
And I think it was really so important, so significant, actually, that after the guarantee of the right, you know, for free speech and freedom of assembly and freedom of religion, why was the Second Amendment right next to that was the right of the people to keep and bear arms? So that, certainly in a hierarchy of ideas, was seemed to be seminal to the founding fathers of America. They thought it was very important. And they really didn't mean that you had to you'd be part of the State Guard or the National Guard or something of the sort, you know, to have a weapon. Wasn't it that, you, as you've gone back and read what the founders have said, didn't they reiterate the fact that it was so vitally important that people had to have weapons to protect our freedom?
That's right, and you have similar phraseology. You have the right of the people peaceably to assemble, the right of the people to keep and bear arms, the right of the people against unreasonable search and seizure. And it was only in the mid-20th century that you have the invention of this doctrine that you had to be in the militia to bear arms. And then it's not really something that's be considered a right, because if you're in a militia or an army or whatever the type of military force, you're normally there by compulsion or like a, as in the case of a draft, and militia service was compulsory back in the old days. And it doesn't make sense, though, to talk about that being a right. When you're in a military force, if you bear arms, it's because they command you to do so in that force. And if you say, I'd rather bear arms and not peel potatoes, let's use that in, as an example, then you'd be court-martialed if you disobey the orders. So it doesn't make any sense to talk about it being a right to bear arms in a militia. It might be a duty, but not a right.
And there certainly, didn't the founding fathers really feel that it was important that the people be armed so that this would be somewhat of a counter to excesses by government? Was this ever mentioned?
It certainly is. It's mentioned widely in the period of the ratification of the Constitution and Bill of Rights that was the experience with the British, that you would need the possibility of having an armed people to defeat a tyranny. It would also be useful as a militia force to defeat a foreign invasion, to help keep the domestic tranquility, and just as a way of fighting crime at home. There were no police forces in those days, and people needed arms for hunting. And consequently, you have the idea that you should be able to keep and bear arms for all lawful purposes, whether it might be personal defense or defense of the state, hunting, or recreation even.
Well, isn't it true, for instance, that anybody who wants to enslave another group will do everything they can to keep them from having weapons? For instance, certainly the colonists did everything they could to keep the Indians from having weapons because they didn't want them to be able to, of course, resist the white man's extension of his domain. Certainly the white men didn't want the blacks to have weapons. It was certainly when they were in slavery, that was the one thing, they were not to have weapons. And isn't this sort of a standard mechanism all throughout the world? Anytime one group wants to dominate another, they want to take away their weapons.
That's right, and you have in the Old South, the slave codes provided that African Americans could not possess firearms. After the Civil War, they reenacted those as they were called the Black Codes at that point, and it was the intent of the Congress during Reconstruction to do away with that. They passed the Civil Rights Act of 1866, the Freedmen's Bureau Act, and that legislation proclaimed specifically that personal security and personal liberty entailed the right to bear arms. And they were talking about freed slaves being able to protect themselves from arms confiscation by state authorities and from Klansmen. And if you want to look at it internationally, you have when the Nazis came to power in Germany, they disarmed all people they called enemies of the state. And that would be their political enemies and Democrats and liberals of all kinds. And then if you fast forward up to 1938, the Night of the Broken Glass, that was a purported attempt to disarm Jewish people. They were forbidden to have arms, and they were threatened with 20 years in the concentration camp if they did.
And so they really would use draconian methods and draconian threats to get the people to turn in their weapons. But certainly when people turn in their weapons, the criminal element doesn't turn in their weapons. And my understanding is that in the areas where the people have been disarmed, why there's a great deal more crime and violence. And wasn't it John Lott, Dr. John Lott, who had written a book called More Guns, Less Crime, who demonstrated statistically that if the people were armed, the incidence of violence and crime went down?
That's exactly right. And it's phenomenal that the District of Columbia had less crime before they enacted their gun ban. And in most years since its enactment, they've been called the murder capital of the United States because the disproportionately high murder rate in that town. And so right now, because of the Supreme Court decision, law-abiding people will have an opportunity to have guns in their own homes for self-protection. The mayor of D.C. acts like the sky is going to fall and that somehow crime will increase, but I dare say it would hardly be possible to be any worse than it is now.
Well, of course, they found, actually, in England, once they took all the guns away from the people, the incidence of gun-related crime actually increased. It wasn't very high before, but it's sure gone up since they've taken the guns away from the law-abiding citizens, because criminals always get guns. So why don't we just pass a law that says all the criminals turn in their guns, and then the law-abiding people can keep theirs?
Right. Well, we do have laws like that, and we also have laws against murder, and criminals somehow murder people. And what's interesting about gun laws is that they assume that criminals will obey such laws.
Right.
They disobey the laws against murder, but if they see a sign that says gun-free zone, they'll flee the scene with their gun. They won't use it because of the sign. So it's a really pitiful argument that somehow criminals would obey laws against gun ownership, but they won't obey laws against murder. So the laws end up only affecting law-abiding people.
And it really was so disconcerting to me to hear the mass media, ever since the Supreme Court decision 48 hours ago, repeatedly interviewing the mayor of Washington, D.C., who says, oh, there's going to be terrible crime now. How could it be terrible crime? They're the murder capital of the world. Could it get any worse now that people can defend themselves against the murderers and killers? I mean, this is organized insanity, and yet so much of the media is going right along with this idea that we've got to have the public disarmed, and that's very disconcerting. You would think the media would be impartial and would report the news rather than try to sway our opinion, you know, and say what a terrible thing. Now the Supreme Court's opened us all up to murder, whereas the truth of the matter is when the people are armed, the murder incidence goes down dramatically.
When you look at the kind of people who want to get firearms lawfully, Dick Heller, who's the one of the people in that lawsuit, he's a security guard. He has a gun, and he guards federal judges in federal court buildings. But when he goes home, he's not trusted to have that gun. It's like he's going to be a raving maniac. And some of the other plaintiffs in that case are people who live in high crime areas. They've been robbed. They've been threatened by drug traffickers. And they're the salt of the earth. They're the very kind of people who are the most trustworthy, and it really insults them to imply that somehow they're going to commit crimes with guns if they get them, that they'll have a lot of legal hoops to jump through. They have to go by criminal background checks to obtain guns. If they have if they want to carry a gun outside the home, they'd have to get a license to do that. And so they're people who are regulated in many ways, and they're the very people who are responsible. And then you contrast that with the mayor, who's getting all this publicity. He's got armed guards. They protect him. He doesn't live in a high crime area. He hasn't been robbed or threatened by drug traffickers.
And of course, the one thing that gets so irritating is Senator Dianne Feinstein, who had a gun and got a gun permit when she was the mayor of San Francisco because she was concerned about her safety. But she objects to any of the rest of us having a gun to protect ourselves. So it seems like it's all right to protect the elite, but not as common folks.
That's right. And in many of these cases, like in D.C., we're talking about people in the poor sections of town, and they don't have police protection. The police couldn't protect them all if they wanted to. There's a legal doctrine that the police have no duty to protect any specific individual, and there's been cases that the courts have decided where people called 911, the police did not respond, they got robbed, they got raped over long periods of time, and they even repeatedly called 911. This is a famous case in D.C., and the courts say there's no relief. You're on your own, basically. So being that that's the case, there's no duty to protect, and there's no real ability to. Any cop on the beat will tell you that. They get there mostly after the crime's been committed. So you're on your own, and if you are an individual, you have human dignity. You want to protect your life and that of your loved ones. What is the problem with individuals being able to do that?
Well, it seems that there are certain people who do not want the people to be protected, other than, of course, they want the elite to be protected. I mean, the Rosie O'Donnells of the world will have armed guards, and the mayor of Washington, D.C. will have armed guards, but we aren't to have any protection.
That's right. In California, you've got a particular problem. You don't even have a state guarantee of the right to keep and bear arms. And you, over the years, you've got one law after another imposing serious felony penalties for mere possession of certain kinds of firearms that are basically no different than any other kinds of firearms. The so-called assault weapon ban in California, these are mainly very large rifles that are used primarily for target shooting. And they demonize these types of guns. They call them assault weapons, and then they make it a felony to possess them. So you've got one law after another like that in the state of California, and similarly in Massachusetts and New Jersey, some of the most draconian gun laws in the country. You've got mandatory sentences for possession of certain kinds of guns that you don't even get those sentences if you kill somebody, as in voluntary manslaughter.
Well, of course, we unfortunately are moving rapidly towards a police state, and what most Americans do not know is that certainly one out of every 32 adult Americans is either in prison, probation, or parole. One out of every 100, adults is in prison, and certainly of the young black men between 21 and 31, one out of every three is in prison, probation, or parole. Something is seriously wrong in America, wouldn't you say?
We've got all kinds of problems, and they're not related to the fact that we have lawful possession of guns in this country. We have poverty, lack of education, breakdown of the family. Young men grow up without any guidance, whatever. They don't have fathers in the homes. And they grow up in this culture of violence and gangs and whatnot. And to try to think there's some panacea where if you just deprive law-abiding people of constitutional rights, that's going to solve anything. It's just so far-fetched, it's a fantasy world.
Well, sometimes, yeah, you're right. Sometimes I think we're living in a world that's gone mad. Other times I'm absolutely convinced of it. But basically, let's get back to this basic concept that our founding intended for the people to have the right to keep and bear arms. It was only in recent years, of course, that they found reasons to get around that, because the people who didn't care about the Constitution, about the limitations placed upon what government could do by the Constitution. So what did their founding fathers, what did you find as you began to study the writings of our founding fathers about their writings, saying the people had the right to keep and bear arms?
Well, when you go to specific individuals, like James Madison, for example, in the Federalist Papers, he wrote that the monarchies in Europe are afraid to trust the people with arms, and that if the people did possess arms, they would overthrow those tyrannies, and in America, we would never have a tyranny because the people do have arms. And Samuel Adams proposed that peaceable citizens should have a right to keep their own arms, and the federal constitution should not violate that. Thomas Jefferson was a big gun collector. I mean, he collected good books and good wines and quality guns. He went on buying sprees when he was in Paris and London, and got huge collections. And he recommended the gun in walking and in exercise and in hunting. That was a way to live the good life and to contemplate, read good books, and carry a gun in the countryside and hunt. And that was considered a well-rounded person, not a criminal. And just one after another, if you look at each one of the founders, I mean, George Washington was another one who had good guns, collected guns, used them in self-defense, not just to lead the Continental Army. So that's what they believed in, and it wasn't until the mid-20th century...
Hold that thought right there for just a moment, please. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Stephen was just talking about James Madison, who had commented that, you know, the people in Europe, the monarchies didn't trust the people because they were afraid that the people had weapons that would be overthrown, whereas here in the United States, the people had to have their weapons so that they could protect their freedoms and certainly protect our country from outside forces, but it was up to the individual to defend our country. Samuel Adams had supported the gun rights. Thomas Jefferson and George Washington were both gun collectors and stressed the importance of the right of the people to keep and bear arms, and pick the story right up there.
Well, as I was saying, it was only in the mid-20th century that the doctrine was invented that people are not protected by the Second Amendment, that somehow state militias are. And then from that doctrine was another argument was made that you can only bear arms if you're in a militia force. That was called the Sophisticated Collective Rights Doctrine. And we went through a period of time when law professors and some historians and some judges, federal judges, would say, well, it's frivolous to argue that individuals have any right to keep and bear arms. And you have them upholding different gun laws. This is starting after the 1968 Federal Gun Control Act was passed. And you have the same thing going on in state judiciaries, where basically they're saying that, oh, this is a frivolous argument. You don't have any Second Amendment rights. Notice that it was the decision yesterday in Heller was 5-4. There we go. But for the grace of God, I mean, we have, because of one vote, we won that case. And
was that Kennedy?
The majority it was.
Who was the swing vote? I mean,
well, Justice Kennedy.
Right. Well, good for Kennedy.
I have something to tell you. I was there at oral argument back in March, and we were all sitting on the edge of our seats waiting to hear Justice Kennedy say something because we wanted to know where he stood, and nobody knew. And early in the argument, he looked at the lawyer for D.C. and he said, well, now the founders, they were settlers, and didn't they believe in possessing guns so they could protect themselves from criminals, hostile Indians, and grizzly bears? Now, there weren't any grizzly bears in the East, but we felt a lot better when he said that because it meant that he agreed with the individual rights interpretation.
Well, I'll tell you, when you see a big brown bear or black bear approaching it, they look pretty grizzly, whether the grizzlies
right.
Are not. Well, look, we're sort of running out of time. I know you can't stay with us a full hour, although I wish we could keep you. But I want you to tell our listeners where they can get your book and, of course, if you have a website you'd like them to go to.
Yes, the website is stephenhallbrook.com. StephenHallbrook.com. The book is on there. If you just Google the name of the book, though, The Founder's Second Amendment, and Google my name, Hallbrook, you could find it on Amazon.com or any of the other, BarnesandNoble.com. It's starting to appear in bookstores. It just came out about a month ago. The easiest way to buy books now, I guess, with the best prices is on the Internet, and it's all over the Internet at discounted prices. So the book is The Founder's Second Amendment, and I hope everyone who gets it will enjoy it.
Well, it's an excellent book. It's an excellent read. And, of course, it's important that we understand what the Founding Fathers felt about our country. Was this actually published by the Independent Institute?
It was co-published by the Institute and also by Ivan D. of Chicago, which is a commercial academic publisher.
All right, fine. Well, it's an excellent read. And, of course, people have to understand our history. That's the trouble, Stephen. So many of our people don't understand our history, and as a result, they're not in a position to argue this. They don't understand why the Constitution was written the way it was, what our Founding Fathers believed. And basically, it's not what the mayor of New York thinks or what the editor of the New York Times thinks. It's what our Constitution is based upon, what our Founding Fathers wrote and believed. We really need to get back to those fundamental concepts of our Constitution. And, of course, now they call the Supreme Court justices to support that. Oh, they're originalists.
Right.
That term, a demeaning term. Well, I think that they're people who are doing what they're supposed to. It's the revisionists, those people who would move us towards a totalitarian state where the government controls everything. Those are the people I fear.
Yes, and the founders wrote the Bill of Rights in a way that ordinary people could understand it. And they intended for ordinary people to understand their rights and to be ready to protect them. And I think with the Second Amendment, both those who own guns and those who believe there's a right to do so, maybe they don't choose to do so personally. That, those people, the surveys showed that the majority of American people think they have a personal right to own guns, and now they've been vindicated by the Supreme Court. But we went through a long period of time when that right was denied, and we still have the elite in denial of that right. The newspapers you're talking about, the media that wants to allow Mayor Fenty to talk but not Dick Heller to talk, they're outraged with the decision, but it's what the Constitution says, and that's what bothers them.
And that's the foundation of our freedom. Stephen, thank you so much for being with us. I'd like to get you onto other programs and carry on the discussion there.
It's been my pleasure to be on the show. Thank you for having me.
Bye-bye.
Take care.
Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and of course, it's a fascinating half hour. I wish we had Stephen with us the whole hour. We're going to, of course, open our lines for calls at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. But people must really understand that there really are those who would enslave the masses. They believe that they are entitled to rule. They believe that they are superior. And, of course, they talk all about, oh, my goodness, the children getting injured by guns going off accidentally, or all the people are committing suicide with guns. And guns are the cause of crime. And so often, have you ever noticed on television, when you're watching television in the evening and they're talking about a gun crime, and they're up in the corner of the screen in front of you is a picture of a gun as they talk about some horrible crime. And what they're doing is they're using the medium to control your reality and to turn you against guns, as if guns are what's killing people. Well, people can kill people with knives. They can kill them by strangulation. But they never want to talk about that. It's really what's in the hearts of people. And then, of course, what we need, of course, is adequate punishment for the people who do use guns in criminal activity. I mean, if guns really are killing people, what we ought to do is take the guns away from the police, take the guns away from the military, and disarm those people who, of course, are protecting our politicians. Wouldn't that save an awful lot of people from being killed? After all, we see time and time again where there's excessive police force, and they kill somebody. I know there was one fellow back in New York. I think he had 60 or 70 bullet holes with him. He was at a bachelor party. He was getting married the next day, and the police just gunned him down in cold blood. Now, maybe they thought he was armed, but certainly it was a mistake on their part. And certainly the important thing is, of course, that people should understand that if the police didn't have any guns, they couldn't have murdered this innocent man. But it would be logical to disarm the police? Would it be logical to disarm police guards that are guarding our politicians? Would it really be logical to disarm the military and by so doing away with war? And, of course, there's very little logical going on. People have to understand that guns in the hands of responsible people decrease the incidence of crime. And it's important that we get this information out. This and the other information available from Radio Liberty is extremely important, and we do hope that many of you out there will want to get Stephen's book and some of the other books we recommend and have carried in the past. We'll be back in just a moment here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and of course, we're going to have open lines the next half hour, so if you'd like to give us a call, our telephone number, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or 464-8295. But let me point out that the truth is there are really people who want a dictatorship, and they want mass slaughter, and all you need to do is certainly look at what happened in Rwanda. First of all, they disarmed the Christians, and then they hacked 800,000 Christians to death in a matter of a couple of weeks. You never hear it mentioned they were Christians. In Turkey, they disarmed the Armenians. The Armenians, and then, of course, the Turks slaughtered 1.5 million Christians, but we never talk about the fact they were Christians. So they, in country after country, they've disarmed the people before they slaughtered them, and people better understand that there really is a conspiracy against God. There is a conspiracy against Christians. So Germany was predominantly a Christian nation when Adolf Hitler came to power, and they disarmed the people. And then they started rounding them up. Of course, they rounded up the Jews, they rounded up the Catholics, and they rounded up the Protestants who were speaking out against Adolf Hitler. And of course, in the German churches, 90% of the ministers there went right along with the Nazis, and they kept preaching Romans 13, saying, "Oh my goodness, God put Adolf Hitler in power. You must obey him." Well, I don't believe God put him. I believe the devil put Adolf Hitler in power. He was deeply involved in the occult and the worship of Lucifer. And they used Romans 13 and they used Christianity to get the people to go along with that tyranny. And I saw Germany at the end of the Second World War. I saw the cities in rubble. I saw the look of hopelessness on the faces of the people there. And of course, in Germany today, the churches are empty because the ministers lied to them. Well, right now we've got Bob calling from Idaho. Our number 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. And Bob, good to have you with us. Question or comment?
Yes, Dr. Stan, did you hear me all right?
Yeah, you sure? You're coming through loud and clear, just like you were next door.
Okay. Yeah. What we're forgetting here is that we had a 5-4 vote,
right?
And one vote. You know, on a 9-man court, just one vote changes and it'll be 5-4 in the other direction.
All right.
And how close we were to that. I think all the appeals courts have ruled that the militia clause in the Second Amendment applies to state guards. But can I read you the wording? It's just a long sentence of the original amendment before it was condensed.
All right, go ahead.
Okay, this is reported in one annual's Congress. Page 778, and of course, they were, as it was reported out of committee, quote, "a well-regulated militia composed of the body of the people, being the best security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed." In short, a militia meant something different then than it does now, and our founding fathers were suspect of standing armies and navies and the rest of it, and they knew that the strength of the people, and even during the Revolution, was in the militia, not in our army and navy, which more or less didn't exist. But is your guest still on?
No, he would only stay with us for half an hour.
Sorry. Okay, but how these other courts. Now, the Ninth Circuit in California, the Federal Appeals Court covers Idaho, and one of those cases, it just ruled straight out, that the militia meant clause in there meant it only applied to the militia. But the reason that was condensed was because in those days it was extraneous, because the word militia meant the body of the people,
Well, I think it's so important to understand that our founding fathers feared government. They saw what had happened in the countries of Europe, where, of course, the kings had the weapons, the people were disarmed. The tradition in England was, of course, that the people could have weapons, but they didn't want the people in the colonies to have weapons because, of course, then they would not be subservient to the crown in Great Britain. And, of course, our founding fathers wanted the people to be free, and they realized that they wouldn't be there indefinitely, and that one day there would be people who would take over the central authority of this country and want to use the central power to enslave the people. That's why they wanted the people to have weapons, because they realized this was the one protection they had against tyranny in the United States. And what a tragedy it is that this is never taught in schools today. And you go back, and this is why this is an important book written by Stephen Hallberg, because he says what our founding fathers said, and they realized you could never trust the government.
Yes, just to back that up, one line from the Federalist, number 46, by Madison. Notwithstanding the military establishments in the several kingdoms of Europe, which are carried as far as the public resources will bear, the governments are afraid to trust the people with arms.
Amen to that. That's right. Let me just put out our telephone number. It's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. But, oh, Chris, what Bob is saying is absolutely true. They did not even want a standing army in the United States. They wanted an army that they could call up in case of war. They had to have a navy because it takes a little longer to put together a navy than it does an army. But they did not want a standing army in the United States. How far we've gotten that from to today, where the United States sends more money on its military than all the rest of the nations in the world put together. We spend more money on our military than all of the other nations in the world put together, and we're told if we need to defend ourselves against, well, communism, but of course communism is no longer dead. Well, maybe we need to defend ourselves against terrorism. And of course, that's one reason why the CIA finances whole terrorist movements starting back in 1980, beginning to indoctrinate many of the Islamic warriors that came from around the world to fight the Soviets. They're there in Afghanistan, and they indoctrinated with this radical form of Islam. They actually spent $53 million, the U.S. Agency for International Development, $53 million on textbooks that were to be used in schools in Afghanistan and Pakistan to indoctrinate the youth in this radical form of Islam. And you're never going to hear about that here, but and if you'd like to get the documentation on it, we'll be glad to send you the article out of the Washington Post. Why would you want to send out, textbooks in Arabic to the youth to indoctrinate them in this radical form of Islam, which had been dormant for 100 years? Well, I personally believe that they wanted to create another enemy. When communism was no longer the enemy, you had to have an enemy. How would you get the people to give up their freedom to follow our leaders? And, of course, Plato had described this in his Republic, but he said when the tyrant has defeated the enemy by conquest or treaty and there's nothing to fear, that he's always going out to find a new enemy so he can rally the people behind him. And do not think for 1 minute that isn't exactly what's going on today.
A question, Dr.
Go ahead, Tom.
Yes. Now, the Supreme Court made another decision here a while back, and it's totally contrary to the last sentence, and this is a short sentence, in Article 5 of the Bill of Rights, nor shall private property be taken for public use without just compensation.
You're talking about the Kelo decision.
Private use.
Right. Right.
It was unheard of until this court made a crazy decision that eminent domain, that is the government's right to grab something, was extended to land developers.
Right.
It sort of scares me because, and maybe your listeners could look this up, just Bill of Rights preamble. Because there was a preamble, as you're aware, but probably your listeners are not. The Bill of Rights was written because Patrick Henry was unable to attend. He was governor of Virginia at the time, and George Washington, who presided at the Constitution Convention, gave him a copy of the new Constitution, asked Henry's input, and Henry looked at it and said, hey, we have to enumerate certain rights, and in that preamble, it makes it very clear that these rights aren't to be dickered with, all right? Quote, the conventions of a number of the state, preamble, conventions of a number of the states having at the time of their adopting the Constitution, and I might add the date of this is December 15, 1791, when it was adopted, okay, expressed the desire in order to prevent misconstruction, this is talking about the Constitution and the Congress, to prevent misconstruction or abuse of its powers, that further declaratory and restrictive clauses should be added.
And I think what's so important is that people have to realize that, of course, there were many people who did, in the states, who said, we don't want this Constitution, and we will only sign the Constitution if you promise to add a Bill of Rights. And, of course, they did promise to add the Bill of Rights. That was a provision for getting the majority of the states to go along with the Constitution. To their credit, they did come back. They did put in the Bill of Rights. I think they're excellent. But isn't it amazing how they've been able to twist the meaning? Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion means a child cannot mention God or Jesus Christ in our local schools. What sort of madness is that?
Well, very simple. Warren Court decided.
Amen. But you have to understand that the reason they did that was because they wanted to destroy the moral fabric of our society, because the Masons control the United States Supreme Court, majorities of 5-4 or to 8-1 for a period of 30 years between 1941 and 1971. Isn't it amazing? None of our leaders will ever mention that. None of our church leaders will mention that. Hey, we got to run. Bob,
the
God bless you.
ACLU, but whatever else, yeah, I think Justice Warren was a 33rd degree.
It was a 33rd degree Mason. They call out the Anti-Christian Lawyers Union, the ACLU. God bless. Thanks so much.
And thank you, Dr. Stan. I do appreciate your show, and I just wish more people could listen.
Well, you just got to get them to listen. Tell them about it. If you want to get some cards, we'll be glad to send you a couple of them to hand out to your friends and insist that they listen. God bless. We've got to go to Tom from Minneapolis. And hi, Tom. How are you doing? Once again, I number 1-888-24-LIBERTY. 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. How are you doing, Tom?
Oh, fine, Stan. How are you doing?
Doing just fine.
Say, Stan, I got your book, what is it, Brotherhood of Darkness.
Right.
And it's a darn good book. You mentioned in there the State Department put Castro in office.
Right.
And I was wondering how that... it seems to contradict, you know, what was written in the Northwoods documents. The Northwoods, that was a Northwoods operation.
Right.
It was given to Kennedy to throw Castro out and overthrow Cuba, and there was also the Bay of Pigs. There was in other words, there was a big interest.
All right, now, first of all,
trying to figure out it seems to be a contradiction. I wonder if you could explain that.
It's not really at all. Who wrote Operation Northwood?
Pardon me?
Who wrote Operation Northwood?
Oh, I think that was the Joint Chief of Staff.
The Joint Chiefs of Staff were not on the inside. They didn't know the State Department, the CIA had brought Castro to power, nor did the majority of the American people. The majority of the American people could never conceive for one minute that the State Department and the CIA had brought Fidel Castro to power, knowing full well he was a communist. Now, how can I make that statement? Well, we actually went and interviewed Ambassador Earl T. Smith, who was the American ambassador to Cuba in 1959, when the U.S. State Department and the CIA turned Cuba over to Fidel Castro, by, first of all, forcing Batista to leave, and then telling Batista, you know, you went under no circumstances will be here beyond tomorrow. You will leave tomorrow. You need to hear that. The DVD is called World Revolution, and it's the only place you'll ever see this interview. But, of course, if you study, for instance, we have a new a friend, Servando Gonzalez, and he's Cuban, and he will tell you, of course, that our State Department knew that Fidel Castro was a communist. And he served in Fidel Castro's army, but he studied this and come to the same conclusions I have. But, you see, the thing is that the members of the Joint Chiefs of Staff didn't understand this. The members of the Joint Chiefs of Staff didn't understand. We didn't send the boys in at the Bay of Pigs, those Cuban patriots, to win. We sent them in to lose. Just like we sent our boys to Vietnam to lose, like we sent our boys to Korea to lose, like we sent our boys into Afghanistan and Iraq to lose the war. People in the military don't really understand what's going on politically. They don't understand that David Rockefeller is a close friend. I should say his daughters are close friends of Fidel Castro's. If you want to document that, it's in a book called Memoirs by David Rockefeller, which we do carry. So what you really need to understand what this is all about is the book Memoirs by David Rockefeller, where he admits being part of a secret cabal that's conspiring to overthrow our government and establish this new international order, and, of course, the DPD, the World Revolution, where you'll hear my interview with Ambassador Smith. But the average citizen doesn't understand. The average talk show host doesn't understand. Most of these people have never studied history, and that's the one advantage we have. We've been around long enough to have actually talked to many of the people who were there when it actually happened. We did the same thing with China. We brought the communists to power in China. You can't get the American people to believe that any more than you can get them to believe that we recently helped to overthrow the government of Nepal and bring the Maoists, the communists, to power there. It's a pattern over and over again. This is why what's going on in South Africa, in Rhodesia, we now call Zimbabwe. Who put Mugabe in power? The United States State Department. Who's keeping him in power? The United States State Department. Oh, my goodness, he's terrible, but we still continue giving money to the United Nations that's funding Mugabe. We still support the Great Britain that's giving money to Mugabe. He would not be in power if it weren't for the help of the United States of Great Britain and the communist Chinese, who we are financing, who are then, of course, going over there and colonizing Africa. Nothing as it appears to be, Tom. And our job is to get the information out.
The government likes us to think that we were over there in Vietnam to prevent communism from spreading, right? And that's not true, then.
Absolutely not. In fact, we have a little pamphlet. It's called The Communist Capitalist Alliance. It's only $3.95 plus shipping. And there you, of course, read the writings of Solzhenitsyn, who will tell you that the American government and American corporations are financing communism. And then, of course, Professor Sutton's treatise, a speech he gave to the Republican National Convention back in 1992, where he talks about how the United States government was funding Russia, that was funding the North Vietnamese, that was funding the Viet Cong, that were killing our boys in South Vietnam. You see, we have the best enemies money could buy, and we have my interview you can see on DVD with Professor Sutton. We carry his books on Wall Street and the Bolshevik Revolution. In the same manner as we funded Adolf Hitler, we funded the Chinese communists, and we're funding this whole radical Islamic movement. Where's the money coming for the Taliban today? Why, it's coming from the Pakistani military. Who's funding the Pakistani military? Why, the Pakistani government. And who's funding the Pakistani government? Your tax money. The best enemies money could buy.
I'd like to get a hold of that DVD and that booklet.
You call us at 1-800-54...
Can I connect me to the operator?
I can't. Do you call 1-800-544-8927? 1-800-544-8927. One DVD is called World Revolution. The other is The Best Enemies Money Could Buy. The pamphlet is called The Communist Capitalist Alliance. Hey, thanks for coming, calling, Tom. Well, you can hang on the line. We're just going to take a little break here and be glad to talk to you.
Okay, thanks very much, Stan.
You're welcome. Well, this is Dr. Stan here. Tom, are you still on the line or not?
Yeah, I'm still here, Stan.
Okay, fine. Do you have anything else you'd like to say?
No, but I have all that information you gave me, and that's what I was really wondering about, though. We put Castro in, and then the Northwoods documents, thing, the Bay of Pigs wanted him out. So that I was just wondering about that contradiction.
We cleared
that up, but that information is on these materials you quoted me.
Yeah, so the story of the Bay of Pigs is really an incredible story, and it's amazing how things work out. Actually, I had an opportunity of one time when I was in Hawaii, being on a radio program over there, and the man who managed the station had been the commander of the war room at the Pentagon. He was a major, but he commanded the war room at the Pentagon at the time of the Bay of Pigs invasion. And he told me that the one place you could have invaded Cuba where you were sure to lose, it was the only place that you were sure to lose, every other place you could have won, because the Cuban people wanted to overthrow Fidel Castro. And, of course, they were to be notified as soon as the invasion took place, and they would rise up against Fidel Castro. They had a massive anti-communist movement in Cuba at that time. But the one place you were sure to lose was the Bay of Pigs. And at the last minute, they switched the invasion site to the Bay of Pigs. They forgot, they just accidentally forgot to tell the Cuban leaders, the anti-communist leaders, that the attack was coming. And then, of course, they promised both air support and supplies for the men we sent in, and deprived them of both when we left them there to die. That was the truth about the Bay of Pigs. But the American people find it so difficult to believe. Why would that happen? Why, very simply, because we had to give the American people the idea that Fidel Castro was the enemy. We were trying to get hold of him, get rid of him. And what happened as a result of the Bay of Pigs? Why, we had to give massive supplies to Fidel Castro to finance his regime to get the men back that we sent in who were taken prisoner. And as difficult as it is to believe, there are people in our government who are very close to Fidel Castro and love him, including David Rockefeller's daughter. And the book, of course, is the book Memoirs by David Rockefeller, which we carry, and we carry that for that very reason. Why would David Rockefeller's daughter be a personal friend in going repeatedly down to visit the wicked Fidel Castro? Because everything is an illusion and a delusion. The last thing they want the American people to know is we finance communism since its inception, because our leaders want an elitist government, and they want to be the elite. Hey, we're out of time. God bless. Thanks very much, Tom.
Okay. Thanks for all your time, Sam.
Bye-bye.
I'm going to order that material. Sounds very interesting.
Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and of course, the material we talked about would, of course, be the interview with Ambassador Earl T. Smith. It's my talk, The World Revolution, available on DVD. And then, of course, there's my interview with Professor Sutton, The Best Enemies Money Could Buy. There's a book that goes with that by the same title. There's a little pamphlet entitled The Communist-Capitalist Alliance. You have to understand, we financed communism since its inception. We never tried to defeat communism. We continue funding it to this very day, even though we have to go out and borrow money so that we can send money to communist Russia. It's all documented there in this little pamphlet, The Communist-Capitalist Alliance. And there's so much other information we carry. Professor Sutton's excellent book, entitled Wall Street and the Bolshevik Revolution, and of course, as you get into that, you'll find out how we funded communism since its very inception. And of course, if you haven't read my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, you need to get it and read it through about three times, especially the part about Bela Dodd, who was a high official in the Communist Party, executive committee of the Communist Party, until during the Second World War, she asked a communist official what would happen if they lost contact with Moscow because of the hostilities, and she was told to go to the Waldorf Astoria Hotel. There were a couple of men there that could tell her the official Communist Party line, and when she got the name, she found out they were some of the most powerful and wealthy capitalists in the United States, and she suddenly realized it was all a fraud. And I will tell you, I've been back to the headquarters of the Council on Foreign Relations at 58 East 68th Street in New York City on a number of occasions, and I will tell you that there you will find all the people who actually go to speak before the Council on Foreign Relations, Fidel Castro, the leaders of the communist movement from communist China, and before that from Eastern Europe, from Russia. Why would the communist leaders be going to the headquarters of the Council on Foreign Relations? They just want to check in with the people who are funding communism, of course. We have funded communism directly and indirectly since its inception. There is actually a three-part book, a trilogy. We don't carry it, but you can get it from the Hoover University Press, called The Western Technology and Soviet Economic Development. Western Technology and Soviet Economic Development, probably available up on the Internet. You need to get it. You need to read it through if you have the time. And it goes into the background of how the United States has funded communism since its inception. And, of course, the pamphlet, The Communist-Capitalist Alliance, explains how we funded the North Vietnamese during the Vietnam War. The best enemy money could buy. And 58,000 American boys died or were betrayed and left behind over there. We don't know how many were actually left behind, how many are still alive. But does anybody really care? Let me suggest something else. Let me suggest a four-tape set called The Men We Left Behind. The Men We Left Behind. The book entitled Kiss the Boys Goodbye, which we carry secondhand. The book One Man Returned. And then, of course, my four-tape set on Vietnam. We never went to Vietnam to win over there. It was simply a diversion to keep us from watching what was going on here in the United States. Because, of course, while our boys were fighting and dying in Vietnam for democracy and to defeat communism, why the government was taking prayer and God out of our schools, was finding that women had a right to an abortion, was changing our immigration laws, was beginning to centralize all power in Washington, D.C. understand that these things don't happen by accident. We actually tell you where you can actually read in their publications. January 1967, Foreign Affairs Magazine, lead article by McGeorge Bundy, who was the head of the National Security Council, instrumental in getting us involved in Vietnam. It's also incidentally the betrayal of the boys at the Bay of Pigs. But he will tell you that the road forward at home is not by getting out of Vietnam. It's by persistence. And if you, anybody who believes in the great new departures in health and education and welfare shouldn't say we ought to get out of Vietnam. The opposite is the case. The road forward at home is by persistence in Vietnam. January 1967, Foreign Affairs Magazine. Our number 1-800-544-8927.
You're listening to the Global Star Radio Network, located at Telstar 5 KU band, frequency 11836, symbol rate 20770. Thank you for listening.
IRN USA Radio News. I'm Greg Moore. Democratic presidential candidate Barack Obama hitting the campaign trail with his former rival.